Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. Of course, I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com here in the sunny climes of Western Japan, where it is currently the 8th of August, 2014. But today I'm joined on the line from the United States by James Perloff, who many of you will remember from our conversation about a month and a half ago about the shadows of power, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the American decline. A very interesting conversation about a very important book, and we did get a lot of feedback on that conversation, people who are interested in that and what we talked about. So I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation, which is about James Perloff's more recent book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, Unmasking the Forces Behind Global Destruction. So James Perloff, it is great to have you back on the program. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
And James, it's great to have you back online after your involuntary vacation. I know that everybody missed you, and I think when your computer went down, I think probably half your listeners felt that their computers were down too.
Well, it is kind of a shared effort here, so I am glad there are so many people who have my back. And, you know, let's keep in mind that so much of our connection here is subject to these electronic interferences that can happen at any time. And it's something to keep in mind for just, you know, to think about a future that is completely controlled by electronic communication, which, of course, itself is completely controlled by the establishment, the powers that shouldn't be. Speaking of the powers that shouldn't be, I suppose we should get into the meat and potatoes of this book that you've written. Quite a thorough book. It covers an incredible amount of ground, politically speaking. And I'm not sure exactly what I was expecting from this book. I think it surprised me nonetheless. Just the scale and the extent of the scope of what you cover in this book. Why don't we talk a little bit first about what compelled you to write this book and what kind of ground you cover in it?
Well, it was the desire to tell people the truth. And, you know, after I wrote The Shadows of Power, I wrote for a while on the creation versus evolution debate, taking the creation side. But after 2001, I was feeling a great urgency to return to the venue of political history. I really sensed the danger and urgency that we all do, what's happening on this planet. And I was giving PowerPoints at the request of patriotic groups. And as I developed those PowerPoints and refined them, watching how my audience was reacting to them, I decided that, for one thing, I needed more than one PowerPoint. Developed a second PowerPoint that I would give to smaller audiences, and finally decided it would be a good idea to turn the whole two PowerPoints into a book. And that's basically what I did, because people were asking for an update on The Shadows of Power, which, of course, is about the Council on Foreign Relations, which I wrote in 1988. It's about the Council, which is the nexus between the establishment and the president's cabinet. It's why we don't get any meaningful change from Republican to Democrat and Democrat to Republican. But there's a lot more to be said than just the Council on Foreign Relations. We know that there's the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, and there were a whole slew of items I wanted to cover to give people the big picture, the false flags, the Fed, which you've just done a beautiful. I've watched your documentary on that. Congratulations. Certainly has been a century of enslavement, but also things like Freemasonry and the environmentalism as a pretext for control. 9-1-1, of course. The control of the arts, the war on faith, the police state, population control through vaccines, weather control. There's a whole picture that needs to be given to people, and I know that you recognize this too, because at the start of your new documentary you use that image of a jigsaw puzzle. I do the same thing on my website, and the analogy, I've used it before, people probably heard me say it, but if you give people just 911 and you're in the truth movement, 911 by itself doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like taking one piece of a jigsaw puzzle all by itself. It's just a piece of color and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And people say, well, why would our own government do that? They need the context, they need the whole jigsaw picture, and once they have the whole picture of the previous false flags that led up to 911 and who's really running the government, and yes, that's why the government would do that, and who controls the media, and that's why we didn't hear about this in the mainstream media, then they see the entire picture, and then that one jigsaw piece makes sense.
Well, that is certainly a concept that resonates with me and definitely portrays my own experience of coming to this truth, because I myself, as people probably know by now, did come to 9/11 truth, I think, first of all, but after having really started to explore that and realized that there was something to it, it wasn't just crazy conspiracy theory, as I'd always been told, I still had trouble accepting it until I saw the Money Masters and realized that there was control over the monetary system, which, of course, starts to put in some of the other pieces of that puzzle together, and it's, as you say, once the full picture starts to come into view, it's almost amazing to think that I didn't see it beforehand, and yet there are so many people out there who are precluded from this knowledge simply because they don't have that full puzzle put together for them, or at least enough of it that a picture comes into view. So let's take a look at the way that this book in particular, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, starts to put that that picture together, and perhaps we can take this from the introduction, in which you write, "The original title of this book was to be How Satan Rules in the World. However, I was advised that this would hamper the book's sales," which I think probably is the case, but certainly I think that probably does provide as apt a description of the book and its thesis as any. Perhaps you can tell us about this overall picture that you're trying to paint for the reader.
Well, the I certainly believe that we're dealing with something that's greater than some rich guys trying to get richer. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Chinatown with Jack Nicholson. There's a conference. Did you ever see that movie?
You know, as a matter of fact, I haven't.
Okay. There's a confrontation. It's about a conspiracy, and it's kind of a not a bad little film about how a conspiracy can work of the rich. And at the end of the film, the hero confronts the villain who's very rich and ask him how much he's worth. He says, "What do you do it for? You know, can you eat at better restaurants? What can you buy that you can't already buy?" And that's a question, you know, you probably want to ask some of those old-time people who created the Fed, John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan. You know, for these guys, they could already eat at the best restaurants. They had the biggest mansions. They drove in the best cars. It wasn't just about more money. For the rest of us, you know, for the average person who's thinking a little bit materialistically, you might think, if I got rich, I'd buy a big home and, you know, I'd buy the best clothes and I'd eat the best food. But these guys already have that. It's about a bigger picture. What's taking place in our world really, I think, boils down to a spiritual battle, ultimately a battle really between control of the planet Earth, for the control of the planet Earth, and a battle between good and evil. And it really takes on, for me, a spiritual dimension. People can certainly view it within just the context of bankers and desiring to be more rich and powerful, which is pretty much how the Marxists might view Wall Street. But I do feel that there is a battle going on between forces that essentially represent God and those that represent Satan. And as a matter of fact, from the intelligence reports that I've read, many members of this establishment that we're talking about actually do worship Satan in secret.
Well, this is something that we have addressed on the program a number of times in the past, looking at groups like the Bohemian Grove and Skull and Bones, which of course have an overtly occultic nature to them. And certainly it's my position, exactly in line with what you just said, that there is more to this agenda than simply the accumulation of money, especially once you realize that this money is just token pieces of paper that are printed out of nothing. I mean, clearly this isn't the end goal for these people. There is a much greater goal in mind. And I am also, as I've talked about on this program before, I'm not a scientific materialist myself. I believe there's more to the universe than what can be weighed, measured, apportioned, and put in a test tube. So, again, I'm sympathetic to this. But, of course, this book is very much guided by biblical interpretation and things of that nature. Let's talk about that, how that plays into this agenda that's being created and how it plays into the ultimate end goal that this these forces are trying to put together.
Well, if you look at the Bible, it speaks in the book of Revelation about a coming figure who, in what Christians refer to as end times, would rule the earth. And in the book of Revelation, it says that he will rule all the tribes and peoples of the earth. And in other words, he's going to govern the world. And what I'd like to point out is that to have a world, to govern the world, you need a world government. And but what many people, even Christians who study things, don't realize is that world government is taking shape right now. We see it on a microcosm of it right now with the European Union, where national sovereignty is being eroded and currencies are being combined into the euro. And we see that model being followed in America, where there has been an effort in recent years to take NAFTA And just as the common market was turned into the European Union, there's an effort to turn NAFTA into a North American Union with our own currency, the Amero, as a regional approach to world government. In fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski said it very well. He said, quote, "We cannot leap into world government in one quick step. The precondition for genuine globalization is progressive regionalization," unquote. And I do believe that we see taking place does have very biblical and spiritual dimensions. We are looking, you know, it isn't just the Christians that say this. The Muslims have also talked about this figure, this evil figure. I believe he's called Dajjal, the biblical equivalent of the Antichrist. And George Orwell talked about Big Brother. We see evidence from their own documents that this entire conspiracy is aiming for a world government that will be ruled by a dictator. You don't have to put him into biblical terms necessarily. That's certainly where I see it coming from, but that's certainly how it's shaping up just in actuality as well.
Well, it certainly is. And again, I think we've documented that unfolding agenda in quite thorough detail here on the Corbett Report over a great many number of podcasts and interviews. So again, there's so much about this this book and what you're arguing in it that I agree with, but I think it would be a disservice not to come to some of the points that I think are points of disagreement that I have, and I'm sure that some of the listeners out there would share. And it comes, I mean, for example, let's take that point of the unfolding of the world government agenda, which we both see and which, of course, I think we're both vehemently opposed to. And it's encapsulated in quotes like this one, for example, at the end of Chapter 5 on Vietnam. You write, "Destroying patriotism, of course, is prerequisite to absorbing nations into a world government. To put it in Marxist Hegelian lingo, war was the thesis, revolution the antithesis, world government the synthesis." So, and I certainly see that formulation, but I think perhaps, for my own money, the more apt formulation of that dialectic would be that nation-state patriotism, I would posit, is the thesis. The globalist institutions, global government is the drive towards globalism is the antithesis, and the ultimate synthesis of that is going to be the global government itself. And I see this as a type of dialectic that both sides, as we know, both sides of a dialectic have to share a certain fundamental underlying idea, which of course shows itself in the synthesis. And I believe that the nation-state patriotism that has been certainly fostered by, as I think you also argue in the book later on, has been fostered by the same people who fomented these types of revolutions, like the French Revolution and ultimately the American Revolution, has been fostered as a way of getting people to subsume their identity and their individuality in a group collective that then can itself be subsumed into the world government agenda. And I think that the answer to that would obviously be to reject that group collective synthesis altogether and to argue for a more individual form of autonomy, I suppose, which is something that I think this book explicitly argues against. So let's talk about that idea. Where does patriotism play a role in this? And in what regards is patriotism itself either been fostered or is itself a solution to what we're seeing in terms of the global government agenda?
Well, there's no question that we have to look at this in context. The establishment definitely will wave the flag when it's time to, and it will make patriotic movies when it wants people to get involved in a war. And there's no question that they will use patriotism as a driving force. At the same time, however, to create a world government requires, at the right time, a breakdown of patriotism. And I think that to take an issue that's controversial today, immigration, one of the ways to weaken the nations of Europe into accepting loss of sovereignty and absorption into the semi-world government of the European Union was to encourage lots of immigration. So in England, whereas back in the 1950s, there were maybe about 10,000 people from Pakistan and India. Now there would be in the millions. Same with France. France has had millions of immigrants coming from North Africa. And in 2005, these African immigrants engaged in riots, and fires were set that the French police could not contain. Now, when a nation starts to lose its national identity, I mean, multiculturalism is politically correct, but when you have all kinds of different national groups within a country like France who don't necessarily identify with Frenchmen or French culture or the French flag, it is easier to take a nation than and to absorb it into a world government. So the context of Vietnam was when I was talking about there was when students were burning the American flag on college campuses. I remember I was a hippie protester myself at that time. From the viewpoint of the Council on Foreign Relations, it is attacked national sovereignty. Richard Gardner talked about the end run around national sovereignty. We see this. Well, let me just quote, and if I gave this quote in our last interview, this is from the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass. He said in 2006, he said, states would be wise to weaken sovereignty to protect themselves. Sovereignty is no longer a sanctuary. Some governments are prepared to give up elements of sovereignty to address the threat of global climate change. The article is entitled State Sovereignty Must Be Altered in a Globalized Era. So I didn't get quite the full quote I wanted there, but this is, there's no denying that throughout its history, the Council for Relations has launched an ideological attack on national sovereignty to prepare the way for regional governments would in turn turn into a global government. But again, they're willing to wave the flag in times of war to inspire people to take up arms that will destroy somebody else's country. So again, it depends on context.
Well, so many things do, I suppose, but I let's try to put some of that into the context. One of the thoughts that occurs to me during your speech, I mean, I do understand that the people who are in charge of these Western democracies are the same people who have been instituting these immigration policies that have changed the cultural and ethnic makeup of many of these countries. I'm aware of that phenomenon, but then as an immigrant myself, now living in Japan with a Japanese wife and a half-Japanese son, I wonder, does that make me part of this globalist drive? Or I mean, to what extent is there room for people to not be bound by these arbitrary lines drawn on maps hundreds of years ago by people that I don't know and have never met?
Well, James, I should mention that I myself, my wife is Chinese, and I have a half-Chinese son. So we are actually very comparable. And I think we need to, again, look at context and separate those individual things. And that does not make us participants in the New World Order. But there's no question that consolidation into a world government requires the destruction of national sovereignty. That is part of their agenda, no question.
Well, I do agree with that. But then again, I think it's just a false choice between either we subsume our identity in the flag or we subsume our identity in the global government. Well, I'd prefer not to subsume my identity in either one of those. But let's go to what I think might be one of the root issues here, which comes from Chapter 8, The Destruction of Nations, in which you write, God's model for government was monarchy. Had we not eliminated kings, Christians wouldn't face the problems they do today. Abortion, banning of school prayer, etc. Christian monarchs would not have allowed these developments, which I think is a contentious statement in a number of respects, not only because I think, I mean, if we just want to argue from the perspective of biblical interpretation, I mean, it seems to me that 1 Samuel chapter 8 is a pretty startling, pretty direct, and pretty pretty straightforward rebuke of the idea that God wants people to be ruled over by kings.
Right, and I acknowledge in that same chapter that I mentioned that kings could be notoriously cruel. There's no question about that. The point that I was making there, James, and I kind of regret that this interview is going so much into disagreement, because I would I actually prefer to I think we agree on more than we disagree, so I'd hope that our show will focus more on the agreements. But in terms of, this is something that I learned from Hilaire Duberrier, who was a great foreign affairs analyst. And it's, what I'm saying is something that goes against the grain of most American patriots. But one thing I learned in studying all of this was that the Illuminati opposed monarchies. And one reason they opposed monarchies was that the monarch is someone around whom a people would rally. he would, he was someone who the people would identify with. And I would like to get actually a quote from my book, if I may, if you just give me a moment here, regarding Bao Dai. He was the emperor of Vietnam, and the United States insist he step down and make room for democracy. And here's what he said: if your country had given me 1/1000th of the sum they spent to depose me, I could have won that war. And here's what Hilaire de Berrier, who knew Bao Dai, said, the emperor of Vietnam. He said, when the throne was destroyed, fragmentation resulted because only the man on the throne was above the regional, racial, and religious hatreds dividing the national family. In other words, traditionally, kings and monarchs were whether it was in France or Spain, people would rally around them. It was a symbol of national sovereignty. That's why the Illuminati hated them so much. When Bao Dai stepped down for democracy, democracy, we can look on it certainly as power to the people, but we see in America how much real power people have. In Vietnam, democracy splintered the nation. The emperor was gone. It became ripe for communist takeover. I'm not deifying monarchies here. What I am pointing out is they tend to unite a nation, and this is why the Illuminati despised them and wanted to rid them. And that's why in Europe, which was once ruled by kings, just as China was once ruled by emperors, as much as we might envy these people, they provided a basis for national identity, sovereignty, and unity. That's why the Illuminati wanted them out of the way. That's the point I'm making. Granted, they are human beings and far from perfect.
Well, yeah, certainly so. But again, that strikes me as the false choice between either democracy or monarchy. And I think that there are other choices on the table. And of course, I mean, listeners to my program will know that I'm an anarchist in terms of my own beliefs. And I mean, even if you wanted to go with the Christian interpretation, I mean, Christian anarchism or libertarian Christians would certainly interpret some of these biblical ideas, I think, somewhat differently. So it's important to put that on the table. But I guess then the question... Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Could I just ask you? I'm sorry to interrupt. Since you say you're an anarchist, then what form of government or any form of government do you support then?
Well, I think government in and of itself is insupportable insofar as it relies on a fundamental violation of people's free will and free choice. Anything that requires coercive forms of basically forcing people into agreements that they don't agree to and that they didn't sign. For example, the Constitution of the United States is technically a contract between, I guess, the government and the people, but one that the people have never signed. I find ideas of the divine right of kings to be equally as insupportable, ultimately, philosophically, as I do the idea that there is a social contract, which we've never seen and never signed, that somehow binds us to whatever the people in Washington want to say is the rules for the United States, or the people in Tokyo for the people of Japan, etc. So I think ultimately, I mean, there's a lot to be said on this, but I would be more in line with what I take to be the real American libertarian tradition of people like Lysander Spooner and the like, the authority of no constitution.
Right. I guess, the John Birch Society had the viewpoint that the ideal government is a limited government. It does seem to me that you have to have government in order to maintain law and order. You have to have a police force, for example, to prevent, although police can become a state police, they can become a Gestapo or KGB, but you may also want the time that you can ring them up on the phone when there's a home invasion occurring and someone's attacking you. And if your country is invaded, you need a government that can organize an army or that can build roads, and these can't be done by individuals. So it's hard to for me to see the viability of an extreme like a total anarchy. Just my own reflection on that.
Well, I certainly understand that, and many people share that concern, including many listeners of this podcast. So it's certainly not something that I insist on as a point of doctrine that all must agree to. It's just my own philosophical position that I've taken and come to over the course of several years. But and I appreciate that this conversation sounds like it's more combative than I think it really should be, because as you say, we have so many points of accord that perhaps we're focusing unduly on some of the points of discord. But perhaps you'll allow me one more question before we move on to some of those points of accord, which is that I wonder then how you reconcile the idea that monarchy is the ideal form of government versus the democracy, which was instituted to undermine the ideals of society. Then how do you reconcile that with the nation-state patriotism of the United States? And I guess the question, perhaps more simply, would be who should be the king of the United States? Should it be Obama? Or I guess just traditionally, should it be Queen Saxe-Gotha, the lizard beast?
The king has been done away with, and there's no way to bring a king back. So it's a very difficult question to answer, and I'm not saying that we should try to put a king in place right now. My point was from the perspective of the bad guys, they looked on the kings as defenders and unifiers of the people that they needed to get rid of to make way for their new world order. We haven't had a king here for 200 years. It'd be pretty impractical to bring one back. So we're trying to fight within the system that we have now. It's the best we can do.
All right. Well, as I say, let's move to some of the points of accord, some of the many points of accord between us on the overall agenda and what's developing that you go over in this book, including Chapter 20, The Secret War on Life, which I found particularly interesting and on point, because clearly, from my own research, there is a coordinated agenda and effort to push this idea of overpopulation and the need for the reduction of human population, which is clearly pushed from the very highest levels by some of the richest and most politically connected individuals on the planet. And I think that is a lie that deserves to be exposed. Tell us a little bit about your position on this.
Yes, I started this chapter by quoting some elites, and I'll just give one quote. Here's from Robert McNamara, another Mr. Establishment type guy, president of the World Bank. In that capacity, he said, quote, talking about population, he said, "We can begin with one of the most critical problems of population growth. As I've pointed out elsewhere, short of nuclear war itself, it is the gravest issue the world faces in the decades ahead. Either the current birth rate must come down more quickly or the current death rates must go up." And I give many comparable quotes from Ted Turner, Prince Philip, Jacques Cousteau, Paul Watson, Zbigniew Brzezinski. The elites are demanding population reduction, and there are a number of means that they have towards that. But the one, this particular chapter, I focused on was because I've noted that it's unrecognized, is vaccines. And I talked to a great extent about vaccines in this chapter. How they may be inducing autoimmune diseases, their exaggerated rate of success, their role in autism, in SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, in ADHD, in Alzheimer's, as a result of the contaminants that are in them, the mercury, the formaldehyde, the aluminum, the monkey protein. Monkey protein is very similar to human protein. If you become allergic to monkey protein because it's injected in a vaccine, you may become allergic to your own tissues. And thus we see a whole host of autoimmune diseases today in the world. And this chapter is filled with quotations from doctors who have stepped outside the box and acknowledged the destruction, and many of them believe this is actually a form of targeted genocide.
Absolutely. Again, the chapter goes into a great degree of detail there, so I will suggest that people take a look at that. Also, another chapter which I think is very important and which you cover in some detail is Chapter 13 on Zionism and the distinction between the Ashkenazi Jews originating from 8th century Khazaria and the Sephardic Jews, the descendants of Abraham. Perhaps you can tell us about that distinction and how it plays into the creation of the State of Israel as a type of false fulfillment of biblical prophecy.
Well, it's something that I'd like to point out to Christians, because Christians, many of my fellow Christians have gotten the idea that we have this owed allegiance to Israel. They see Israel as the reforming of biblical Israel that it's a work of God, that he's brought his chosen people back to his promised land, and we have an obligation, therefore, to support the modern political state of Israel, regardless of what it does. And as far as the Ashkenazi goes, one of the claims is that these are the chosen people, therefore they have the right to the land. And I've seen Christians giving speeches saying that as we have to even support the taking away of land from Palestinians, the occupation of Palestinian land. I have a map in that chapter showing how much land the Palestinians have lost. In possession of most of Palestine. Now they've lost most of it. The importance of the Ashkenazi Sephardic Khazarian distinction is that many Jews apparently are not actually descendants of Abraham. This was brought out in the book called The 13th Tribe by Arthur Koestler. He was a Jewish writer himself. I should mention I'm of half Jewish descent myself. Arthur Koestler pointed out in his book The 13th Tribe that in the 8th century, the kingdom of Khazaria, which was north of the Caspian Sea, had converted to Judaism as a state religion. It had rejected both Christianity and Islam, was under pressure from both in the political world of that time. And as an alternative, it converted to Judaism. That's right in Wikipedia. You look up Khazaria there. And they became, according to, at least to the estimate given by Koestler, 90% of the people call themselves Jews today. The significance being that not being descendants of Abraham, even if you wanted to stretch the Old Testament and say apply to today, they do not have a right to that land that they have stolen from the Palestinians.
Well, again, I mean, there's a lot to be said there, and you do talk about that and show, for example, some of the maps of encroaching Israeli settlement of that area, etc. So obviously something of great relevance today with the ongoing ramifications of the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. And you do talk about some of the Irgun terrorism that was used to bring about that. The creation of the State of Israel, etc., and the Balfour Declaration. So again, a lot of important bits of history there. But let's take a look at another, I think, important chapter. This is an interesting chapter because this is not something that I see covered very often in the alternative media, but it's there. We talk, for example, at great length about the Rockefeller's funding of the eugenics movement in the United States from its very inception, and rightfully so, I think, an important subject. But one thing that we don't talk about when it comes to Rockefeller money is the funding of ecumenism. Ecumenism. I never say that word out loud, so you'll forgive my fumbling with it. But you document this in chapter 17 of the book, The War on Faith. Perhaps you can tell us about that ecumenist agenda.
Yeah, it's tough because it can be ecumenism or ecumenicism. There's different choices that makes it even fuzzier in the pronunciation. But yes, along with one world government, they also want the pathway, James, to control is consolidation. So they're consolidating governments, consolidating the EU countries. They want to consolidate Canada, Mexico, and America into a North American Union. You also see consolidation taking place in multinational corporations. You look at how the bank mergers, how the Warburg's Manhattan Bank merged with the Rockefeller's Chase Bank, became Chase Manhattan. Then Chase Manhattan merged with J.P. Morgan, became J.P. Morgan Chase, and J.P. Morgan Chase merged with Bank One. It's consolidation. It's a pathway to control. But they will also want, in addition to one world government, they want a one world religion, and that is what the term ecumenism is referring to. It's referring to the coming together, not just, ultimately the goal is not just to ally religions with each other, but to turn them into one. In order to do that, I spoke in this chapter, I documented how the Rockefellers had funded the modernist movement. They'd funded seminaries like Union Theological, which back in the 19th century was Charles Briggs, who is a professor at Union Theological, who prominently introduced into America what they called higher criticism, and which was saying that the Bible was full of errors and that it was not written by the people who said it was. And then 1922, I talk about this, there's a landmark sermon given by a pastor named Harry Emerson Fosdick called Shall the Fundamentalist Win? And he attacked the fundamental beliefs of Christianity, the virgin birth, the resurrection, the miracles, these weren't, he wasn't just quibbling over some gray area of scripture. He was actually attacking all the major fundamentals of Christian faith. He was forced to resign his pastorship, but then was immediately hired as pastor of Riverside Church, which was the church attended and built by John D. Rockefeller, who then paid for 130,000 copies of that sermon to be distributed to Protestant pastors. What they were doing is they were trying to fund the degradation of the Christian faith, take it down from being a unique faith so that it could be blended and merged with others. As part of that, I should mention, they also created a structure for that. The Rockefellers funded what was called the Federal Council of Churches. It's now called the National Council of Churches. And it was an in-law of the Rockefellers, John Foster Dulles, who spearheaded that. He was also on the Rockefeller Foundation, and he was a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He then went to Amsterdam and attended the founding conference of the World Council of Churches, and the director of research for that was John C. Bennett, who was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and president of Union Theological. You see, it all comes together, Rockefeller, CFR, and religion. We often don't recognize the religious component, but this ecumenism was part of that drive, and as a motivation to get religions to start coming together, working together, they proposed that they downgrade their religious doctrines and focus instead on good works, social action. And so the Rockefellers backed a pastor named Harry F. Ward. He headed something called the Methodist Federation for Social Action, which still exists today. He's also the founding chairman of the ACLU. Very unusual position for a pastor to be holding. But that is part of their plan to ecumenicize the world, bring religions together as part of the system of control. You have to understand that something like Islam has to also be subdued for this one world government to take place. There cannot be any remaining strong forces of independence.
Well, again, this is an important and I think often overlooked part of the overall agenda, and it does explain so much about why there is so much money and authority wielded by these Rockefellers and other connected families in order to try to dominate and steer religious movements and tendencies. And they themselves participate, as I say, in these groups, the Bohemian Groves and Skull and Bones and other overtly occultic groups behind the scenes. So, I mean, there's a lot to be considered there. And again, Chapter 17 deals with that in such detail. And there's so many specific pieces of information like that, which you just cited. So, again, I think that's really important for people to at least start considering why there has been so much money and time and effort spent in trying to control and steer the world ecumenical movement. But then let's contrast that with Chapter 16 of the book, The Arts, which is about the way that the entertainment culture creation industry is steered and fostered for the purposes of steering society, which again is a point that I've certainly made on this podcast before and which I'm very much sympathetic to. But I find that the paucity of footnotes and information in this chapter is somewhat frustrating because it deals with a subject that I think is important and particularly a subject that I'm greatly interested in, which is the idea of the authorship of the Beatles oeuvre and where did the Beatles come from and who promoted them and how. Which again is something I'm very much fascinated by, but unfortunately the only footnotes in this chapter are one to John Coleman's work on the Committee of 300, and another from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram by Ed Wallace, who asserts that Brian Epstein hired the Screaming Girls to arrive at JFK International when the Beatles first came in 1964 to the United States, and that some of the members of the audience at the Ed Sullivan Show were likewise paid plants, which is certainly an idea I'm 100% sympathetic to. It would be surprising to me if that first wave of Beatlemania was not simply a creation of Capitol Records and whoever else as a type of PR. But the issue, as is asserted here, according to Coleman, although Lennon and McCartney eventually wrote some of their own songs, the music on their first albums was created at the Tavistock Institute in Sussex, England, with a footnote to John Coleman's work. And he also suggests, for example, that Theodore Adorno had a part to play in this, and others have suggested that Adorno actually owned parts of the Beatles catalog. This is an issue, again, I find it interesting and fascinating, and I would love to find more substantive information on this, but I have genuinely tried with research to try to find outside sources verifying some of the assertions that Coleman makes in his work, and I have been completely unable to find them. So I wonder if you have more in terms of links or resources that people can look at in terms of this assertion about the Tavistock Institute and its part to play in the creation of the Beatles, or if it all does just source back to Coleman?
Well, one thing that you could look at that was published very recently on Dr. Henry Mackow's site, he has an article recently published there, and the title is something like this: was the 1960s golden age of rock a psyop? And it's not written by Mackow, it's written by a guest author, and they talk there about how, for example, Jim Morrison of the Doors, very popular rock group in the 60s, his father was actually the admiral in command of naval forces in the Tonkin Gulf. And this author draws a lot of associations between military and intelligence families and some of the rock and roll that was being produced. And I find it pretty credible, Coleman's assertion, that a lot of this music was being created and a lot of the fanfare being created. And the analogy I drew was to democracy. You know, when I grew up, I was told, you know, any boy can grow up to be president. And we had this illusion that, just work hard enough, you know, you can rise to the top. Then we find that, in fact, there is an oligarchy working behind the scenes that handpicks the presidential candidates. And what I realized as I read this information was that a very similar process is behind the arts, that what we think are these artists who have risen to the top on the merits of their own talent or popularity. Quite often the song has been written for them, and the fanfare, like the screaming girls at the airport. I remember when the Beatles came to America in 1964, and the girls at the airport, I've read separately that the girls actually came from one school in Brooklyn. They were paid $20 apiece, and most of them apparently didn't even know who the Beatles were, but they were told to scream. But when the Beatles arrived in America, James, it was like the Pope had arrived. It definitely was not just a garage band. There was a mass, the major TV networks were all in on it. The Beatles were put on the cover of Look and Newsweek. There was definitely a movement of the establishment, and the Beatles then became the centerpiece of the entire change of the social order. So I definitely believe that this was orchestrated.
Well, again, I am sympathetic to the idea, and certainly the overall idea that the entertainment industry is really the culture creation industry and is steered from the very top by people in suits, not steered from the bottom by the whims and fancies of young girls and boys. I certainly agree with that. But again, it's just some of the specifics that I have trouble tracking down, and I don't tend to believe anything until it's proven to me, especially the Tavistock-specific connection to the Beatles. I'd love to find out more about that. So if there's anyone in the audience who has any more specific information on that we can turn to, I'd be interested to see that. Well, I've covered, I think, some of the topics in here. There are many, many more. There's a chapter on 9/11. There's a chapter on Vietnam and the various wars that have been started in the last century based on lies. There's chapters on the war in Iraq and the ultimate agenda behind that. This book covers so much. But are there any other points about the book overall or the thesis that it's attempting to make that you'd like to state for the readers here?
Well, for one thing, I wish that we spent more time, as I say, talking about the points that we have in common. I was going to make a joke. I should probably talk about the chapter on 9/11 because I doubt that your listeners have heard anything about 9/11 up until now. On my website, jamesperloff.com, I do have links to articles I've written that go into much greater depth. The first chapter of the book is called Six Wars, and it's about six false flags or six deceptions, and I talk about the Spanish-American War, sinking of the Maine. And, you know, James, there's just no evidence whatsoever that Spain sank the Maine, although the battle cry was Remember the Maine and to hell with Spain. The Spanish, just take this as an example, because where the book is beginning, you know, the Spanish did not want to fight a war against America. They had a wooden navy, we had a steel navy, and that imbalance of power is proven in the battles of Manila and Santiago, where we vanquished their fleets and suffered only one casualty. We didn't even lose a ship, we just had one casualty in each battle. The war was being fought over the turf of Cuba, which had become the world's largest sugar producer and wealthiest colony in the world by the 19th century. It was coveted by people in the establishment here in America. National City Bank specifically took over its sugar industry after the war. And it was National City Bank that loaned us $200 million to fight the war. And the president of National City Bank, Frank Vandalip, he actually had been assistant secretary of the Treasury during the war. He negotiated that loan, and he became president of National City Bank as a reward for negotiating that loan, which was paid for by a tax on the American people that lasted for 108 years after the Spanish-American War. That was the first war we ever fought for somebody else, to right somebody else's wrongs. Instead of fighting for our own self-defense, it was the war that began the Anglo-American alliance, because out of the Spanish-American War came, in 1898, they formed the Anglo-American League. England was the only country in Europe that sided with America during the Spanish-American War. And from then on, we were England's ally in World War I and all the wars that came thereafter. After the war, Spain was forced to leave. I should mention that President McKinley, Freemason, was beholden to John D. Rockefeller. He had gone bankrupt while he was governor of Ohio. He was bailed out by the Rockefeller forces led by Mark Hanna, Rockefeller frontman who'd been John D. Rockefeller's classmate in high school. Mark Hanna then became the political boss of McKinley and became the White House boss, his political manager. The critics of President McKinley called him McHanna. The reason I'm bringing this up, Jim, is because there's a lot of detail that I've written about that I'd like kind of like people to know about. And you and I have been kind of just trading some friendly barbs about some issues we disagree with on, like, monarchies. But I'd like people to know that there's a wealth of information that I've tried to get into this book, and that they can find more elaboration on in my website. I talk about six wars. Spanish American is just the first. The Lusitania is the next one, and on my my website, jamespoloff.com, you'll find on my blog an article called False Flag at Sea, where we talk about how the Lusitania was loaded with munitions. It was not protected by destroyers. Winston Churchill knew it was in the path of a U-boat. There were four destroyers nearby in the port of Milford Haven. They were not sent to escort the Lusitania. It was a setup. And I talk about these six wars. Pearl Harbor, we had full foreknowledge of that war. The Korean War, how it was artificially created by giving Joseph Stalin and the Soviets control of North Korea as a reward for the Pacific, helping win the Pacific War, when they didn't enter the Pacific War until 5 days before Japan surrendered. Of course, I talk about Vietnam and Tonkin Gulf and the Iraq War and the non-existent weapons of mass destruction. But I've tried to get a lot of information in here, James, that people can make use of. And my intention in writing the book, even though there's some points of controversy in it, was to give people a full picture of what has led up to the current world crisis we're facing today. And so I start with six flags is an amusement park. and then I go, the second chapter, I talk about the CFR, how there's a wealthy oligarchy ruling America from behind the scenes that pre-picks presidential candidates. You can go back and find that out by reading Ferdinand Lundberg's 1937 book, America's 60 Families. But I talk about the CFR and its goal of world government, which is, of course, the subject of my book, The Shadows of Power. Chapter 3 is about the Fed and how I've got a graph in there showing how there was really no net inflation in America before the Fed came to being. So I talk about the Fed, how it's debauched the currency, and how it has been the under the control of the same Wall Street oligarchs ever since Jekyll Island. I have a chapter on how they've run America, how they created the Marshall Plan, the World Bank, the United Nations for their own benefit. I have a chapter on the war in Vietnam, a chapter on the North American Union, one on media control, how basically you have about a half a dozen giant corporations controlling the media in this country. You can just take, let me just take one example of that. If you take Time Warner, they control CNN, they control Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Money, Fortune Magazine, People Magazine, HBO, New Line Cinema. They controlled AOL until the recent spinoff. That creates a false consensus. That's what we're fighting against here in the truth movement and the alternative media, is the mainstream media, which is it's that consolidation of ownership and control that gives people this false sense that there's of consensus about what's happening, which creates necessity for programs like this one and for the Corbett Report and for your website. I'm sorry to just be talking about the book. I'm just trying to give people an idea because we sort of got waylaid with a very valid point of disagreement. But I also talk about methods used to that take down nations. We kind of already touched on that. Again, there's a chapter on the supranational, beyond America, beyond the CFR, organizations like the Treadwell Commission and the Bilderbergers. We talk about the history of revolutions and how they're financed from Wall Street, including the Bolshevik Revolution. A chapter on Freemasonry, on environmentalism as a pretext for control. We didn't go into that much into Zionism beyond the Khazarian aspect, but I do, and as you touched on, go into the whole history of the creation of the State of Israel, including the Balfour Declaration and the attack on the USS Liberty and other things that American patriots need to know about before they lend unqualified support to Israel. And again, a chapter on all the discrepancies in 9/11, a chapter on the police state, cyber tyranny, weather control, and so forth. So it's an effort to give people a resource that they can give with, even though that chapter, and I agree, we could use more documentation on Tavistock and the Beatles, but with documentation, I want to give people a credible and complete, yet not a tome like Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, something that you can read, feel comfortable with, give to your friends, that's a scoffer, that doesn't believe in alternative media and what it's saying, and give them that full crossword puzzle that we're talking about at the beginning. That is what I'm trying to accomplish with Truth as a Lonely Warrior. And by the way, what you yourself are accomplishing, even if we have a couple of points of disagreement with the Corbett Report, which I personally feel is the best resource out there, I really appreciate the thoughtful analysis you give. You're not a fist-waving revolutionary. You analyze things a lot. I actually would compare you to Sherlock Holmes. You take these world events and you analyze them rationally and logically. And the questions you've asked me have been good questions. And with a couple of extra minutes of thought, I probably could have answered them a little bit more eloquently than I did. But I'm glad that we have these points of disagreement too, James, because it's from disagreement that we work things out. And I look at this, I agree we should have more than John Coleman's word for that on the Beatles and a few other resources. And it was a short chapter, but I didn't have a lot of information about it, but I felt it was a subject I didn't want to let go. I felt that the cultural manipulation is so important, I had to say something about it, even though I didn't have that much detail. But I've been trying to give people the truth as best as I know it, as you are. We're both working for trying to make a better world.
Well, that's the point. I think we are working towards the same goals overall, and I think that is the point that we should concentrate on. And my apologies if you feel this conversation is not concentrated enough on what the book actually covers. I think you did a pretty admirable summary there in the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Really. I had to get that in.
Yeah, and rightfully so. I mean, there is a lot of material here that covers a lot of very important subjects in a great degree of detail, so I think obviously the book is valuable on that point, and if I didn't make that clear before, then that is my fault as a communicator. But as you say, I think it is important also to explore the points of disagreement because they do exist, and they always will exist. I mean, there's no one on this planet that I agree with 100%, even myself, I suppose. I mean, I've certainly changed my mind in various capacities over the years, and I probably will in the future. So I think we do need to continually explore those boundaries. But I was glad to see in the chapter 23 in conclusions you wrote, at the risk of offending some people, I suggest that all believers, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, stand together against the Antichrist in his New World Order, for his war is on all of us. I'm not talking about ecumenically blurring all religions into one, which is something the Antichrist himself will attempt, but a united stand for survival. I hope the distinction is clear. In a battle, when the enemy's artillery is firing, we can't get too fussy about who's sharing the foxhole, which I think is an important statement, and I guess I would expand the boundaries of that statement beyond simply the religious bounds into sort of all of the various aspects of disagreement on points of political ideology, etc. And I think it is important. And that's one of the principles I tried to go with in the Corbett Report, is that I'm certainly not trying to form some sort of doctrine that everyone must agree to in order to be part of this conversation. My point is that we have many, many points of agreement. Let's work on those points together towards our shared goals. And that seems to be the point that you're trying to make there in chapter 23.
Right, and I and not mentioning atheists, I didn't mean that we should kick the atheists out of the foxhole.
But there are no atheists in foxholes.
Oh, that's true. That's right. That's right. That's right, too. Also, just to pick up on your point, it's important to disagree sometimes, because sometimes it's important to change your mind. And I'll just give you an example of that. How much time do we have left here, by the way?
I have to be running along to another interview, so maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay. Just to give an example of that, I wrote an article 2 years ago on the Lindbergh kidnapping and drew a conclusion about it. But after making 500 posts to the Lindbergh kidnapping pro board's discussion board with many experts, I've completely changed my mind because the evidence has convinced me that I drew the wrong conclusion. And it's very important that we do that sometimes. I should say all the time, because we should always be open to the fact that we may be wrong about something. So I'm glad we have some disagreements. And again, my hat's off to you for what you're doing, because you're right. We'll never agree 100% with everyone. If we look for a wife or a pastor or a boss or a friend who we're going to agree with 100% of the time, life would get pretty boring. And we would never really make any valid changes.
Exactly. Well, I think, again, an impossible goal. So again, I mean, there's a lot of incredibly important material in this book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. Tell people the best way they can get a hands on the copy of this book.
It is in Kindle, and it is in paper bound. You can get it on Amazon or from your local bookstore. And I think the best way to get a description is just to go to Amazon, click on the book description, but also go to my website and click on the books there. Again, the website is jamesperloff.com. And very, very grateful to you for having me on as a guest and for all that you're doing. I hope I haven't said that too often, but...
well, I appreciate your time. And let me once again throw in a recommendation for The Shadows of Power for anyone who hasn't picked up a copy of that yet. I think the single best work on the Council on Foreign Relations that I've read. So, again, some very important works. They will be linked up in the show notes. James Perloff, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Corbett.